Sandecker was working at his desk, so intent that he did not immediately notice that Rudy Gunn had entered the office and sat down across from him. Gunn was a little man with a genial disposition. The remaining wisp of hair across the top of his head, the thick horn-rimmed glasses, the inexpensive watch on his wrist, suggested a dull and colorless bureaucrat who slaved away unnoticed in a cubicle behind the water cooler. Gunn was anything but colorless. As assistant director and chief of operations, he was known to possess a brilliant mind coupled with a pragmatic instinct, and he ran the day-to-day operations of NUMA with an efficiency unknown in other government agencies. "Sorry to interrupt, Admiral, but we have a serious problem. The Deep Encounter and all on board have vanished," he told the Admiral what had happened.
"How long has it been since they last responded?"
10 hours. Gunn braced himself for the outburst he was sure would come. Sandecker reacted as expected.
10 hours? My instructions are that all survey and research ships on station maintain status reports to our communications department every 2 hours.
Your instructions were carried out to the letter. Deep Encounter responded as scheduled.
You've lost me.
Someone claiming to be Captain Birch made contact every 2 hours and gave updated reports on the project. We know it was not the captain because our voice systems did not accept the voice patterns. Someone was attempting to imitate him.
Obtained from whatever source, NOAA or one of the security agencies, expanded satellite photos for a 1,000-square-mile grid of that part of the Pacific. I don't want to miss an inch.
After accepting the disappearance of the Deep Encounter in the vast emptiness of the sea, Pitt, Giordino, and Misty settled into the tight enclosure of their submersible and concentrated on staying alive. They found no trace of flotsam or an oil slick, so optimism overcame pessimism, and they assumed that for whatever reason the survey ship had sailed away and would soon return. But night passed. The sun rose and set twice more, and still no sign of the mother ship. Worry unfolded, and they began to suspect the worst when, hour after hour, their eyes scanned the limitless horizon and saw nothing but green sea and blue sky. No ship or even a high-flying jet liner made an appearance. Their onboard GPS told them they had drifted over the international dateline and were moving far south of the shipping lanes. Hope of a rescue dwindled. Water was the first priority. Fortunately, rain squalls were frequent. A vinyl mat that covered the floor of the sub was spread out and held over the hatch. It caught the rain and sent it down a crease into the water bottles they'd carried on the dive. After the sandwiches were consumed, they began a project for catching fish. Using tools carried on board for emergency repairs, Pitt fashioned a series of hooks, while Misty relied on her artistic talent for making colorful lures out of any material she could find. For fishing lines, Giordino disassembled electronic wiring and connected it to the hooks and lures. They cast out several lines and were rewarded with 3 small fish that Misty identified as frigate mackerel, which they quickly cut up, used for bait, and chummed in the water to attract more fish. They ate sushi style down to the last morsel. The 4th day broke under gloomy skies. The routine never varied. Catch water if possible, catch fish if possible, and search the horizon. Each person stood a 2-hour watch. During Misty's watch, an aircraft flew within a mile of the drifting submersible. Despite her frantic waving of the floor mat, the aircraft continued on.
"It was a rescue plane," she cried. "He flew right over and didn't see us."
"We're awfully hard to spot," Pitt reminded her. 3 more planes flew over and failed to spot them. Pitt tried to hail them over the portable radio, but they were out of range. Giordino soon developed a flair for catnapping, and then coming awake 15 minutes later, almost to the minute. Sweeping the horizon and seeing no light for the 10th time that evening, he dropped off into his temporary dreamland. He woke to music. Initially, he thought he must be hallucinating. He reached over the side, scooped up a handful of seawater, and splashed it on his face.
Out of the night came a Strauss waltz. He recognized it as Tales of the Vienna Woods. Then he saw a light. It looked like another star, but it was moving back and forth in a small arc on the western horizon. He jumped down through the hatch, groped for a flashlight, and climbed up again. Now he could see the vague outline of a small vessel, and dim light showing through square windows. He switched the flashlight on and off as fast as his thumb could move the switch and yelled, "Over here! Over here!" "What is it?" Pitt called out below.
"Some kind of boat," Giardino shouted back. "I think he's headed our way."
Pitt tried to contact the vessel.
"Hello, hello, please respond," he implored.
His only reply was static. Suddenly a voice cracked over the submersible speaker.
"Who am I talking to?"
"Castaways," Pitt snapped back. "You sailed right past us. Please reverse course."
"Hold tight, I'm coming around,"